Black Agenda Radio, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, Barack Obama's FBI is waging its own war of terror through raids on anti-war activists and entrapment of Muslim immigrants. And author David Swanson discusses the lies that are told in the service of war. But first, President Obama's Deficit Reduction Commission has created political momentum for attacks on Social Security and government spending in general. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research and author of the new book, Taking Economics Seriously. We asked Baker if he found it strange that President Obama created the Deficit Reduction Commission in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really is. I sort of hoped it was a political tactic that it might make some of the blue dogs, the centrist Democrats, more comfortable in supporting stimulus. I don't know whether it was the intention or not, but they didn't get the stimulus, and certainly the commission now has really put a big emphasis on cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, and that's kind of front and center public debate. I don't think where President Obama wanted to be, but maybe I'm wrong on that.
Well, it seems like he commissioned a Frankenstein. Why is Social Security part of deficit reduction? I thought Social Security had its own income track.
Well, it does, and it really doesn't belong in there. And the commissioners, the co-chairs, I should say, Erskine Bowles and Senator Simpson, more or less have said that. They said that, you know, we recognize it doesn't contribute to the deficit, but, you know, I joked about it. I think they're hoping to get extra credit. It's not really their agenda. They weren't asked to do it. We don't need them to do it. So it really doesn't belong as part of the equation.
Then why is Social Security mentioned in every breath, every sentence about deficit reduction?
Well, you have people that have wanted to cut Social Security for decades here. I'm thinking Pete Peterson is, you know, both symbol and reality, that here's this wealthy investment banker that's put up over $1 billion to promote deficit reduction, with much of it centered on cutting Social Security. So this has been an agenda for him and some of the other people in this debate for a long time, and they see this as an opportunity. There's concern about the deficit. Let's run out there and try to go after Social Security.
Now, you write that the real problem with the economy was the collapse of the $8 trillion housing bubble.
Well, yeah, you go, why are we in this downturn? You can't tell a serious story that we're in this downturn with 25 million people unemployed or underemployed because we had the deficit. I mean, that's close to crazy. In fact, the deficits were not that large until the housing bubble collapsed. I mean, one could argue if you go back to 07, maybe they were bigger than they should have been, but they were not terribly large deficits. And then, of course, the housing bubble brought down the economy. The collapse of the housing bubble, I should say, brought down the economy. And when that collapsed, that made this huge gap in tax revenue and, of course, spending increases on things like unemployment insurance. So suddenly we're looking at large deficits. But that's a response to the economy. That's not the cause. And, in fact, we'd be much worse off today if we didn't have the deficits, because that's supporting demand in the economy. If we didn't have the deficits, unemployment would be higher.
Now, supposedly, countries with high deficits are subject to attack by the market. What is this market that devours whole nations?
Well, you know, this is this kind of boogeyman that these people are holding out there, and certainly countries can be profligate. They can face problems with support for their debt in financial markets. But to compare the United States to Zimbabwe, as some have done, or, you know, Greece, a more recent example, it really is very misleading. In the case of Greece, it's a country that tax evasion is a national sport. The estimates are that more than 30%, 35% of their taxes go uncollected. We don't have that problem here. It's a relatively small country. We're a huge country with a diversified economy. And perhaps most importantly, we have our own currency. Greece is like Nevada. If Nevada got into really bad financial straits, they probably are, but if they got into really bad financial straits and they tried to borrow lots of money, well, yeah, they would have problems. United States, at the end of the day, you know, the Federal Reserve Board can buy up our debt if need be. And in fact, it's doing that. And what someone could rightly say is, well, you have problems with inflation. And there are stories you could tell where that would be true. But right now, our biggest problem is the opposite, that we have almost no inflation, and there's a lot of concern, which I share, that prices could start falling.
Bowles and Simpson's, their template, calls for even lower corporate tax rates.
Yeah, I mean, that would not be a priority for me. Corporations are doing just great right now. Corporate profits are actually recovered from their pre-recession levels. Their share of national income has never been higher, at least not, you'd have to look a long time, I'll just say that. Maybe back in the 20s it was higher. Cutting their tax rates wouldn't be a priority now. What I can say, and what they do propose doing to some extent, is taking back some of the tax breaks that they get so that they actually pay the tax rate. So currently we have a 35% tax rate, but very few corporations actually pay that. I could see taking back some of the tax breaks and lowering the rate a little bit, but I'd want to, at the end of the day, have them pay more taxes, not less. And what their policy is, that they end up paying pretty much the same and possibly somewhat less.
You wrote a wonderful article about a year ago in which you compared President Obama not to Franklin Roosevelt, but to Herbert Hoover.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I am worried about that. I mean, I wasn't doing that out of any desires to see President Obama mimic Herbert Hoover. My concern was that we would go that route. And what we had, you know, he did come through with the stimulus early on in his administration, and that was good, but the problem, of course, was that it was nowhere near big enough. His own chief economist had advocated a stimulus about twice that size, and she was actually overly optimistic in her projections for the economy. So we needed a much, much bigger stimulus, and the problem is we're coming to the end of that. The stimulus is fading out in this quarter, the fourth quarter of 2010, and even more so in the first quarter of 2011, and the economy is very far from recovered. So I'm worried that we're going to be in a situation where we're doing the exact opposite of what we need to be doing. We'll be talking about balancing the budget, which is going to put further strains on the economy. That means cutting spending, raising taxes at a time when we're already desperately short of demand. And this is the Herbert Hoover route. So, you know, unfortunately, I think we are seeing President Obama, in effect, follow that path.
You speak of further strains on the economy. How does that work out in ways that people actually feel?
Well, if you, I mean, some of the stuff, and this is remarkable how little some of these things get attention, but we have data, house prices are falling again, and it looks like they're falling fairly rapidly. So people are going to see more of the equity they have in their home disappear. That's going to lead to more people being underwater. People cut back their consumption because they realize they don't have any savings. So that's going to be a problem. But from the government side, when you reduce your deficit, you're pulling money out of the economy. So what that means is you're either cutting spending, so you have government workers that you're laying off, or we now have a freeze, so workers who might otherwise have seen their pay keep pace with inflation are not going to see that, so they have less money to spend. Or on the tax side, they'll be raising various taxes, and that also pulls money out of people's pockets, so there's less money to spend. So the basic story is that we have a very weak economy that needs more demand, and rather than getting more demand, we likely will get less demand, and that's going to lead to less growth and more unemployment.
President Obama, with his freeze, two-year freeze on federal workers' paychecks, seems to be sending two signals. One, that what's wrong with the economy is that workers are making too much money. And two, that federal spending is somehow a drain on the economy.
Yeah, and that was really troubling. I mean, it's, you know, on the one hand, I don't like to see the hit to federal employees because, sure, you could find some that are overpaid and, you know, you want to identify them, cut their pay. But, you know, across the board, it's really not fair to people that, you know, for the most part are not terribly well-paid workers. So to try and imply that that's the problem is just very much misleading. And that federal spending being, you know, sort of falls into this idea of federal spending being out of control. And this is just an invention. I mean, I took a look at this the other day just because I was curious. You know, I mean, I know the general numbers, but I went back to 1980, an arbitrary year, but I don't think it would matter if I picked a different year. Said, what were we spending relative to the economy in 1980 compared to what we're projected to spend based on President Obama's budget in 2020, so 40 years. And the increase over those 40 years was just over a percentage point in GDP. So the idea that we have out-of-control government spending when it only increases one percentage point of GDP over 40 years, I mean, that, there's nothing there, and there's just no reason for President Obama to pretend that this is the issue. The numbers are very clear. It's not.
It sounds like the Republicans and now lots of Democrats are fulfilling the dream of the right wing, starving the beast being the federal government, so that it can't generate social programs and such.
Well, they're certainly going after the social programs. I mean, one part of the story will be interesting. I wasn't happy with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the military buildup over the last decade. It'll be interesting to see if they're willing to cut back that side of the budget. But they certainly are looking to cut back big on, you know, the important social programs that people look to, Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid. These are programs that tens of millions of people depend on or expect to be dependent on when they're retired. And they're none too generous now. I mean, that's what gets me. They talk like, you know, people are living the good life on Social Security, and just go, not in this country. I mean, it's a great program. I mean, I'll argue, you know, to my death, it's a great, great program. But the idea that somehow it's excessively generous and we have people living, you know, high on the hog based on their Social Security earnings, that's crazy.
And some so-called conservatives are proposing that Social Security be means-tested. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's really a very, very cynical ploy. I mean, I don't know if everyone who proposes that's being cynical, but the reality is they say, well, you know, Pete Peterson, the investment billionaire investment banker, says, well, I don't need my Social Security check. There are very few billionaires, so we don't, you know, he could send his check back or not. It doesn't really affect anything. But when you say, okay, we don't want wealthy people to get it, well, you have to have your definition of wealthy go down pretty low, like 50 or 60,000 a year, in order to have any significant sum of money collected that way. And even then, it ends up being very sloppy because it's very difficult. In effect, a means test on Social Security and Medicare, it's like a tax. You know, it's like putting a very, very high tax rate on middle-income people. They're, by definition, almost all of them are retired. It's easy to avoid, to find ways to game it. So what you end up doing is putting in a structure that is going to be manipulated, it'll be gamed, it's going to be very unpopular, and probably not save a lot of money. So it's the sort of thing that pretty much economists across the political spectrum would say is a non-starter, but as a rhetorical tool to cut Social Security benefits, you know, you could win a lot of points that way.
And also, if Social Security was means-tested, then it would fall into the category, in folks' minds, of welfare, and it could be demonized.
Exactly. You know, part of the strength of Social Security is that everyone benefits from it. So there's very few people that don't feel themselves to be benefiting from Social Security. The Pete Petersons that can just say, I don't need my check, those are few and far between, you know. So we don't really have to worry about those people. You're talking about people that, you know, if they earned in their lifetime a decent wage, $70,000, $80,000 a year, they're solidly middle-class people. They get a benefit. It's not a great benefit, but it's something they count on, something that will be important to them in retirement in almost all cases. And I think it's important that they're included as beneficiaries of the program. Otherwise, you're going to undermine support for it very quickly.
Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We spoke with another progressive writer, Jonathan Tessini, whose recent book is titled, It's Not Raining, We're Getting Peed On, The Scam of the Deficit Crisis.
This whole hysteria around the deficit and debt is misplaced. What we should be focusing on is the real crisis in America, which is over the last 30 years, the people of this country have been robbed. And they've been robbed by an economic system that has shoveled more money to the top 1%. Now, this seems to me so obvious as to not need to be said, but in the political world of this deficit commission, they almost shovel aside, they want us to frame it in one very small square, and they want to put aside what I think is the real challenge, which is how do we stop the robbery of Americans, give people decent wages, decent jobs, and stop giving the top 1% a crazy amount of our wealth. We should have jailed a whole lot of other people. We should have demanded that anybody who got financial assistance, meaning any company, every single one of those top executives would be forced to resign. We should have replaced the whole top echelon, the financial community that drove the economy over the cliff. And at the same time, we needed to invest a lot more money in getting people jobs. My major criticism of the stimulus and all that stuff that went on 2 years ago is that it wasn't big enough. It should have been at least double the size and because the fundamental crisis in this country has nothing to do with the debt or deficit. It's about the fact that people don't have good paying work.
Well, the Federal Reserve is made up entirely of bankers. Why would one expect a group of bankers to care about workers?
You're right. The bankers don't care about it, but the Congress has the power. Our elected officials, in theory, and I understand the whole complication and corruption of campaign finance and who they are responding to, but truthfully, the Congress has today enough power to direct the Federal Reserve and to force the Federal Reserve to do things that it needs to do in terms of full employment. You're right. Federal Reserve, the bankers are not going to look out for the people. Most bankers are not oriented that way. But it's the people we need to hold accountable and vote out of office are the people in Congress who are not doing their job.
But it appears that Congress and certainly the corporate media are using the Obama's Deficit Reduction Commission as a kind of template for future action, doesn't it?
I think that's right. And, you know, beyond this commission, my biggest fear and the reason I think we need to speak out about this in the coming months is this is going to be the template. This is going to be the mantra. This is going to be the way in which the Democrats and particularly the president, I believe, seek to have quote-unquote bipartisan agreement on certainly fiscal issues with Republicans in the next budget. And leading up to 2012, we're going to see a lot more of this rhetoric about the deficit and debt crisis and how we have to cut. And I am very fearful that that is going to hurt a lot more people. We have to struggle against this. Absent mass demonstrations in the street, and this is something that happens in Europe all the time, unless people get into the streets, and, you know, the ranks are there to do that. If you look at the huge numbers of unemployed people that we didn't have 2-3 years ago, one in five Americans does not have decent paying work. We have almost 10% officially unemployed, but far deeper than that. I honestly don't have much faith in the Democratic Party to organize this, and I'm skeptical that the non-political organizations are that motivated to do it. I don't know who is going to start it, but I do think that we have to have people in the streets. We have to demonstrate. We have to go in front of the country clubs where the rich people are who refuse to pay taxes.
Author Jonathan Tassini. Vigils have been scheduled for every first Friday of the month in New York and 10 other cities to protest lack of government action on the jobs front. One of the organizers is Noreen Connell. She says the focus on the deficit rather than unemployment is counterproductive.
Well, it's sort of a Hoover. President Hoover was the president before President Roosevelt and during the Great Depression. And even President Roosevelt, when he first got elected, thought that the important thing was to balance the budget. As the Depression went on, the realization came that, no, we have to work our way out of depression. And that is our prescription and our fix for the economy. You cannot have a jobless recovery. The recovery must include lots of jobs, whether that's with the private sector or the public sector.
The country's largest professional nurses union is calling on Congress to scrap the Deficit Reduction Commission's recommendations entirely and instead focus on putting people back to work. The National Nurses United Union also demands extension of unemployment benefits and that Medicare health coverage be made available to everyone. Dorothy Ahmad is a registered nurse and union member in Chicago. She's especially angry that President Obama's commission recommended the Social Security retirement age eventually be raised to 69.
Can you imagine your nurse, if you were in a hospital? I'm a registered nurse. I have been working since I was very young, and almost 30 years. And I'm looking forward to retiring at age 62 because nursing is both physically and mentally demanding. And for a nurse to take care of someone else at the age of 69, it just doesn't make sense to me because of the demands, you know, that it puts on a nurse. You cannot take care of somebody else at 69. A nurse needs to retire at 62 and let somebody else take care of her. President Obama needs to step up his game and understand that he cannot agree with anything like that. If he has to veto or use his vetoing power, I don't care what he has to do, but he cannot go along with that. No compromising. We don't want to hear it. The nurses supported President Obama, and we put him into office, and we hope, we just hope that he doesn't agree with that, because a nurse just can't take care of a patient at the age of 69. I could see me right now in a wheelchair and a scooter coming in to take care of somebody, giving them their medication. She's just not physically able to do that.
But, of course, President Obama is the one who appointed that commission.
I'm saying he needs to take it, and they need to rethink that. Even though I don't think President Obama understands what that will happen to him, even in the future. That's a political bullet, as far as I'm concerned, because I supported him, but I would no longer support him if he allowed something like that to go into a law.
Federal prosecutors are attempting to coerce 14 Midwestern anti-war activists to testify before grand juries investigating whether they gave so-called material support to terrorist organizations. Joe Osbaker is among those who've been subpoenaed. He explains how the feds are perverting the grand jury process for political ends.
Until 2 months ago, I didn't have a thought in my brain about the role of the grand jury. We have all been through a steep learning curve. The grand jury is an undemocratic tool for repression. I have no question at all. We have learned about the role of the grand jury in repression of the Puerto Rican liberation movement, in repression of the anti-war movement, and the black liberation movement of the 1960s, and really the grand jury has been used as a tool of repression in just about every decade since the founding of the Republic. You know, it really is just an unbelievably repressive instrument. You know, for people who don't know, I did not know 2 months ago, you don't have a lawyer when you go in front of the grand jury. There is no judge. The jury is selected by the prosecutor alone. There is no screen for bias among the jurors. The grand jury sits for 18 months. You do not have the right to confront your accuser. You do not have the right to call witnesses or present evidence in your own defense. And the way it's been summed up most succinctly for us is, any prosecutor worth his or her salt can get the grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
And, of course, it is a crime to not cooperate or collaborate with that prosecutor in the grand jury process.
You know, that's the thing that's most chilling about all this. I mean, on September 24th, my wife and I had 25 FBI agents in our home for 12 hours. I mean, my wife and I are both archivists. Well, to be truthful, we're both pack rats. And we've been activists. I've been an activist for over 30 years. My wife was active even as a child against the Vietnam War. And we have, you know, over 100 boxes of files of all of our movement activities. And the FBI came and they went through, 25 agents, 12 hours, going through everything in our home. They were especially looking for phone numbers, names, email addresses. They were looking for who our associates are in the anti-war movement, in the Palestine Solidarity Movement, and they took much, much more than that. But that's just where the repression began. Then we were subpoenaed, both of us, for this grand jury. And even though, I'm going to tell your listeners something, Glenn, when this is over, mark my words, there will be no evidence of any money given to any organization overseas, neither terrorist or otherwise. My wife and I, and none of the 14 who've been subpoenaed, have ever given any money to anyone. There is no material support for foreign terrorists.
Of course, that depends on what they define as material support.
This Supreme Court decision that came down in June, I think, was the match that lit this fuse, because basically what the FBI and Justice, what they believe is this Supreme Court decision has given them the power, has basically redefined material support to include speech, to include thought. If one of us were to make a statement in support of a movement against repression in Colombia, and a so-called terrorist organization or a group on the State Department terrorist list were to add their names to that statement, that would be evidence that we were providing material support for that terrorist organization. The irony of this, of course, is that Barack Obama wrote the introduction recently to Nelson Mandela's, to a republication of Nelson Mandela's autobiography. And in there, Obama said, as a college student in the early 1980s, he was inspired to political activism by the example of Mandela. And at that exact moment in time, Ronald Reagan's State Department placed the African National Congress on the terrorist list. If this law, which is in place now and under which they are carrying out this investigation, if it had been in place 30 years ago, Barack Obama could have been accused of exactly the thing that we're being investigated for supporting Nelson Mandela.
And yet Barack Obama's attorney general has initiated these raids that have put you in this predicament.
Well, we know that the Joint Terrorist Task Force does operate under justice, and therefore we know that Holder has to be aware of this, and so we are directing our pressure right now. In fact, the thing we are in Washington for is we are asking legislators to send a letter to Holder and President Obama stating that what is happening to us is repression. It is an example of the FBI and the grand jury being used as tools of repression against the anti-war movement. And, believe me, the irony strikes us every day, my wife and I. The night that Barack Obama was elected, Stephanie and I and our sons, we walked several miles through the crowd to get to Grant Park so we could join in the celebration of this great victory, the defeat of the Republicans, first and foremost, but also the election of the first African-American president. And, we were not fools. We didn't expect that, the election of a Democrat was going to, change the United States from being an empire. But we certainly didn't expect this.
And now they are fishing in your house.
That's exactly right. And when they brought it to us, my wife and I were the first two that they called to testify. And, we deliberated on it. And, we spoke with our children about it. And we spoke with our parents about it. And we spoke with our colleagues and comrades about it in the anti-war movement and in my union and in Stephanie's union and everybody. And we decided that we could not, in all good conscience, testify to the grand jury. And so we stood up and said, no, we won't be part of it. And all 12 subpoenaed, all the others that have been targeted by this, they made the same decision. All 14 of us said, no, we won't cooperate with this witch hunt.
Longtime activist David Swanson has published a new book. It's called War is a Lie.
the lies that they tell us about the wars include, you know, spreading democracy, attacking demonized dictators, benefiting people with humanitarian aid, eliminating weapons of mass destruction, preventing imminent attacks on the homeland. There are endless lies that are told before, during, and after these wars that are demonstrably false or at least minimally important to the real motivations. And I look at in the book in chapter 6 what some of the actual motivations are that seem to be there. It almost seems to be a reversal in terms of the more important motivations are the ones least talked about, at least in public. Most of them are not secret at all, but they are just not repeated endlessly on a loop on TV. So the economic motivations, the imperial outreach to new bases in new strategic regions, the seizure of resources, the opening of markets, the electoral calculations, the sheer profiteering off the wars and the reconstruction. But then once I've looked at all of those reasons, it still doesn't seem to explain these wars fully. There seem to be wars that are fought with the planners fully aware that they have little to no chance of succeeding on their own terms, that it's hopeless, that they are going to dig themselves in deeper, that their plans are going to come to nothing and they're going to waste more blood and treasure and come to the same result, namely hopeless, pointless failure. And so some additional explanation seems to be needed.
Well, some of us believe that in the case of U.S. imperialist wars, that the reason for the naming of places there where there are no resources and very little population and no strategic value as strategic is because an empire needs to stamp out any example of independence from empire.
Well, that's right. And a lot of the language that you see in documents from the Project for the New American Century or other think tanks that are pro-war and pushing for war, and a lot of the conversation that you see in private that comes out later in the minutes of meetings or in the testimony in closed session committee hearings that is published decades later, it seems to be about dominance and control and respect. And there seems to be an understanding among war planners that, you know, I document in terms of specific individuals in the book, but that it would be much, much worse to appear soft, to lose the credibility, as they call it, that comes with smashing any evidence of resistance around the world, than to pull out of hopeless wars that are going to fail on their own terms. And so you see meetings of war planners where they come together, decided they're going to have war, they're going to escalate a war, they're going to launch a war, and they have to decide a reason why for their own, in terms of their own strategizing, after which they'll devise the reasons to tell the public, which is, you know, an additional step. But the wars seem to be predetermined before we figure out why. And a lot of the explanation seems to be ego and machismo and this idea of gaining self-respect as individuals through this communal effort to destroy other nations.
When you have a system in which war is a business and in fact a very huge business, why is there a need to have any other reason for war?
Well, there might not be, and it's been true for centuries, and was, you know, highly recommended in early books on propaganda that began coming out after World War I, that wars be sold to Wall Street and to corporate America as good for business, whether or not they would be, and that is still done, and it's done openly in newspapers. It's just on page 15 and mentioned once, and it's not on the front page, like the evil demonic dictator we're saving each other from, or the spreading of democracy, and yet wars in a broad sense are horrible for business. They're horrible for the economy. They're destroying the U.S. economy right now. We're dumping everything into the military machine at a cost, in terms of jobs, in terms of economic benefit. It's a negative trade-off. But in the short run, and for specific individuals and specific corporations, it is very much a profitable enterprise. And that machine, whether or not it's good for the economy as a whole, has become a very powerful force driving wars, driving Congress members to support all wars always, and having these weapons built in little bits and pieces in dozens of different congressional districts in order to tell those Congress members this is about your people's jobs, it has become an art form, and this is something that's growing by the year, every single year, including these years of Democratic power in Washington. Every year the military gets more money, and it has more money than the next 14 militaries on the globe combined, at the same time that our weapon sales to other countries far outstrip any other national competitor. The United States leads the way by leaps and bounds, and most of the wars we fight are fought against weapons that were manufactured in our own country. This is our big business. And so that is a huge, huge part of it. And yet there is a broader economic interest in putting an end to this course.
In the United States, we have companies that don't just service wars, but reap huge profits in the aftermath of wars. I'm speaking of Halliburton and others like it.
Well, that's right. The so-called reconstruction has become a huge source of unaccountable profits and profiteering as part of the war industry, and it's been a completely privatized effort, that is, government money to private corporations. But the wars themselves and the occupations have been largely privatized as well, which has increased the profits dramatically, so that we have more mercenaries and contractors in our wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in most locations, then we have strictly U.S. troops, service men and women, as we so misleadingly call them, and that's become a huge motivation for dollars into political campaigns and electioneering to keep the wars going. And as we've legalized bribery, which has sort of come to its fulfillment with the decision early this year by the Supreme Court to take away all limits on corporate money spent on elections, we have further empowered the economic force, the profiteering force for war. And so that has become a much more difficult force to overcome. At the same time, that the right-wingers have boxed themselves into a corner, demonizing the deficit as evil as any foreign dictator, to the point where the Cat Food Commission, the Deficit Commission, is talking about major cuts to the military. But we have to be very careful, because they seem to be leaving a loophole for wars as if that were something other than the military, and a further loophole for overseas contingency operations, which is nothing but the Obama name for the global war on terror. And so we may see huge attacks on spending in the name of the deficit, with a pretense that they're going after the war machine as well, in equal measure to which they're going after useful spending. And it may be a pretense.
Wars, of course, are not just products of the classes that benefit them, but they have a cultural component. What role do you think American Manifest Destiny has in creating a public support for not just any particular war, but American wars in general?
Well, Americans think of themselves as different from the rest of the world, whether they think that that's a God-given right or not. Certainly the majority do. But I was on a very progressive, very intelligent radio show yesterday where I was asked, as is quite common, don't we have to stay in Iraq and Afghanistan now that we're there for the sake of the Iraqis and the Afghans? And never mind that the Iraqis and the Afghans say, hell no, thanks anyway, get out. We have to do it for their own benefit in the name of democracy, whether they like it or not. And it's just indisputable that few, if any, Americans would put up with that attitude were the tables turned, were it China or Canada occupying the United States, and the United States in political and economic turmoil, and our fate uncertain, and things likely to be chaotic when the occupation lifts, there is not an American to be found who wouldn't say the first responsibility of these foreign occupiers is to get the hell out of our country, and then we'll see what we can figure out. And of course, that is the attitude, and it's well known to be the attitude of the majority of Afghans and Iraqis. And yet you have this reversal, this idea that it's morally desirable to stay in these countries against the will of their people, and against the will of our own people, by the way, with a majority of Americans now against these occupations. This is a very twisted sort of morality to put on a cover for wars. Wars which at the very same time still get a big chunk of support from a different segment of our population who want to wipe those people off the face of the earth. And so it's become possible to sell wars to a particular segment of the U.S. population as humanitarian and generous, while at the same time continuing to sell them to a different slice of the populace as a way to attack evildoers and evil races and evil religions and so forth. It's all very self-contradictory when you look at it as a whole.
Barack Obama was sold as a peace candidate. Was that a bait and switch?
Well, you and I didn't believe he was a peace candidate. Many people didn't believe he was a peace candidate. He was marketed as such by a corporate media that shut out of coverage anyone who was a serious peace candidate. So our friend Dennis Kucinich didn't exist in election coverage, and among those who were mentioned in the stories, it was possible to depict Barack Obama as the peace candidate. But still, you had to go with what he was saying on his flyers and at his rallies about ending the war being the first thing he'd do, and avoid what he was saying in detailed interviews with the newspapers, which was, I'm going to build the military larger than it's ever been, which he's done. I'm going, you know, with excluding World War II, depending on how you look at it, but larger than it ever was under Bush and Cheney. I'm going to escalate the war in Afghanistan, which he's done, you know, and I'm going to kind of sort of partially end the war in Iraq, which he's done. So that being the standard for what counts as a peace candidate, and certainly it did in comparison with candidate John McCain, that's not what you would start out with if you were simply aiming to create a peace candidate. And even so, he has disappointed on his own promises, just as he's going back now on his explicit promise to end Bush's tax cuts for the millionaires and billionaires. He has gone back on many promises, including his timetable for getting out of Iraq, his level of completeness for that withdrawal from Iraq. And it appears that he will be going back on the Bush-Maliki treaty to get everyone out of Iraq by the end of next year, which will now happen with a Republican Congress that will be working with the president to fund the wars, which will probably come to be known as Republican-Obama wars or Obama-Republican wars, as the Democrats in the House are turning more and more against them, aided by their impotence, their ability to hypocritically oppose the wars while they have no ability to stop them. So I think we have for the very first time in history a president who received a Nobel Peace Prize, went to Oslo, glorified war, said Martin Luther King Jr. was wrong in his Peace Prize acceptance speech, and had not a slightest tremor of response out of America. No humiliation, no outrage, whereas if a Republican had done such a thing, you would still be hearing the shouts and cries about it. So I think that while everyone in the White House, while everyone in the Pentagon understands fully well and undoubtedly informs the president that these wars are hopeless and pointless and counterproductive, even with Rahm Emanuel gone, it's not clear that anyone is telling President Obama or that anyone could get through to him that these wars are bad for him politically, electorally, come 2 years. And until that happens, he's going to continue on the course that Lyndon B. Johnson continued on, and he ended up unable to run for another term, as did Truman, as did Polk, as have a number of American presidents who went full steam ahead with wars, living inside a bubble in Washington where everyone says, yay, warrior president, but the public can't stand it, and I certainly hope won't stand it any longer.
Do you expect different behavior from the Democrats in Congress now that half of the Blue Dog Caucus is gone and one-third of the new Democrats, the Democratic Leadership Council, is gone?
Well, I expect more or less the same behavior from those who are there. I expect the leadership to interpret the Blue Dog losses as the result of them not being right-wing enough. And, you know, they will, of course, argue that Democrats lost in swing districts and Democrats won in safe districts, and that fully explains the more progressive Democrats winning and the worse Democrats losing. I don't think that does fully explain it, but regardless, it results in the so-called progressives, as that standard is met in the halls of Congress, being almost a majority of the Democrats in the House. I think that what could make a difference would be for the Progressive Caucus or the Out of Afghanistan Caucus or some caucus to actually become a force, to actually do what the Blue Dogs did while they were there and had numbers, and that is to take a stand where they don't just put out nice rhetoric, but they take a stand and they withhold their votes on things that don't measure up. You know, even if they were to do that and were to develop a fundraising base and support their caucus members in their reelections, which we know the Democratic Party doesn't do, they would have less power at the moment because the Republicans are in complete control in the House, but they still would begin to develop power. What might make a difference and is more likely to make a difference in terms of the Democratic caucus in the minority is simply the fact that they are in the minority and that they are going to have a majority of their caucus having already turned against the wars, having voted against the escalation in Afghanistan back in the end of July. And the fact that with the Republicans shaping the votes, you aren't going to have these pretty excuses for voting for war funding, where Democrats have in recent years been able to vote for nice rhetorical gestures, I'm against war funding, or I want a non-binding exit strategy request, and so forth, and then turn around and vote yes on the money. The Republicans aren't going to give them those rhetorical amendments. The Republicans are going to say vote for the money or don't, and they may make it even easier by putting more money in than the president wanted, or putting more abusive measures in than even the White House wanted, in order to differentiate themselves from Obama, whom they despise. And so it may become all the easier for the Democrats, not to mention the more libertarian Republicans, to vote no. And so that number we had back in July of 114 Congress members, 102 of them Democrats, voting no on war funding is likely to go up. The question is how much conviction is there behind it? Can we turn it into something real when we have a chance to have a majority of Congress members on that side? I think it's possible. We've been building under the radar for the past decade the number of Congress members who will vote against war funding, and has gotten up to 114. And if it keeps growing, I think that has some potential. But we have to be aware of hypocrisy with these people.
And I'd like to note that number included two-thirds of the Congressional Black Caucus. From your perspective, what's the lay of the land at the grassroots? What are the prospects for a revival of the anti-war movement during Obama's term?
Well, I think, you know, having wasted a couple of years, they're not as good as they would have been if we'd never shut down. I think that, as in all activist campaigns, money makes a difference. And a lot of people who were funding the peace movement up through 2006, where we see in George W. Bush's new book that we had a lot more power than most people allowed themselves to believe, that we had the Republican minority leader in the Senate telling Bush to get the troops out of Iraq before the 06 elections. You know, we're led to believe we're absolutely powerless, and yet a little bit more push in 2006 might have made the difference, might have saved hundreds of thousands of lives and additional disaster and waste of billions of dollars. And more funders, of course, most funders of anything to do with peace disappeared the minute that Barack Obama was elected. And, you know, a lot had disappeared when the Democrats got the majority, January 07, and then more November 08 when Obama was elected. If some of that money were to come back, or if people like George Soros and all the millionaires and billionaires who are always demonized as progressives on Fox News but never actually fund anything progressive were to take this opportunity of the Republicans seizing the House to actually fund a progressive movement that included and made central the demand for peace, then all things would be possible. I think even short of that, there will be some growth in the peace movement now, for partisan reasons, and for serious reasons of disappointment among those who had bought into the hope and change. I think that with this obsession with the deficit, that this new movement that's really growing, to demand a shift in priorities from the military machine to where we need the money in jobs and housing and energy and education and infrastructure, has some potential. It's certainly more of a conversation among the elite in Washington than it's ever been in recent decades. And so there is some possibility there. And of course, there are great groups that have never let up, like Veterans for Peace, that is leading the charge with this protest that I certainly plan to be part of on December 16th, where we will go to the White House and demand that the wars end, and chain ourselves to the fence and be willing to be arrested. And I certainly encourage anyone who can get off work, who can take the day and afford the travel and so forth to be there with us, you know, a few hours in uncomfortable handcuffs with a bunch of friends is a small price to pay for anything that could pressure them to reverse course here.
That was David Swanson, author of War is a Lie. The United States government has long been in the business of manufacturing enemies at home and abroad. Black Agenda Report's Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
The cynical practice of manufacturing crimes in which to entrap victims for prosecution is so old, so time-worn, that it has a name. For more than 100 years, the cops engaged in this practice have been known the world over as agents provocateur. Provocateurs are regular features of police states on every continent. In what's become a depressingly familiar scenario in the United States, federal authorities in Portland, Oregon, singled out an ignorant, isolated, economically stressed young male Muslim with no family nearby and with few, if any, close friends. They paid his rent for several months. They put money in his pocket and bad ideas in his head. They put him in touch with other cops who claimed to be in Pakistan and Yemen. When their prey snagged a job in Alaska, they put him on a no-fly list to keep him from leaving town. Finally, the FBI furnished the young man with fake bombs, with cell phone detonators, and a van, and arrested him when he tried to set off the fake bombs. By now, there have been many arrests of this kind. In some of them, FBI provocateurs had to rent cars for their hapless bombers, had to feed and clothe them, had to teach them how to use simple cameras. Federal cops purchased weapons for them and put them in alleged touch with pretend jihadis abroad. police agents concocted fanciful crimes, often far beyond the means of the supposed criminals to accomplish. Imaginary capers like blowing up the 100-story Sears Tower or menacing New Jersey synagogues, crimes that might never have existed, even as thoughts, without the instigation of police provocateurs. Terror scares of this kind, followed by arrests of the patsies, are invariably greeted with a chorus of bipartisan approval from corporate media and establishment talking heads. The latest has been no exception. These scares are good politics for whoever's in office, and they're good business for the ever-expanding Homeland Security state. The climate of fear that sustains and flows from them is just as politically useful to a Democratic White House as it was to a Republican one. This is one area in which many Americans must have imagined that the ascent of a black president and an African-American attorney general might have made a difference. It has not. The only difference is that while the Bush terror threats were widely mocked and ridiculed, many so-called progressives have silenced themselves in this, the era of Obama. Sadly, neither the practices nor the political uses of police state provocateurs have changed at all in the first 2 years of the Obama era and are not likely to change in the next 2 years. There's probably no shortage of ignorant, benighted, white Christian youth who might be offered fake bombs and maneuvered into pretend bombing plots for which they too could be arrested if that were a federal priority. But then, some kinds of terrorism are more politically useful than others to both Republicans and Democrats in our bipartisan police state. No matter what color the Democratic president and his Democratic attorney general happen to be.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio, produced by the same team that brings you BlackAgendaReport.com on the Internet. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.